Your Atkins, take one, side one. So could you tell me something about your meeting with Huss?
Put it this way, if I may. We've just had the 50th anniversary commemoration at Auschwitz, liberation of the camp. And therefore there's been a lot of talk about Auschwitz. And I have found now that the circumstances of Huss's arrest are not known. And I feel that it is worth recording. And my memory in this respect is absolutely precise. And I'll tell you why. It's made up of everyday and unusual things. I was with, as you know, the War Crimes Commission for the British Zone and the legal department I was attached to for my own research. That's not for the good of the legal department. And in charge was Group Captain Tony Summerhoff, quite the most brilliant man that I have come across, and certainly the most brilliant wit. And this is not a personal opinion, but of course supported by another great wit of his day, Melford Stevenson, who had the highest regard and who felt that Tony Summerhoff was one of the few people in life who lived life without any ambition whatsoever. And therefore, in his opinion, in Melford's opinion, had wasted a great deal of his capacity. But I added that he gave infinite joy and inspiration to anyone who knew him. Right. We come to the fact that I am never punctual in the morning. I never have been. It is not my time of day. And there's no particular reason why I should be very punctual at the mess for breakfast or the office. On this particular day, I was greeted by the last person having breakfast that morning. I think you are particularly late today, as it could be. And on arrival in the office, oh, thank God, you've turned up at last, the group captain wants you. So I go in and go to the Summerhoff. And he says, well, you've been holding up proceedings. I said, have I? And how and why? Well, because we pulled in Rudolf Huss this morning at 6 in the morning. And he's now in Tomato. Tomato being a little prison in Minden, not far from Bayernhausen, where we only held people that we particularly wanted to interrogate. It was convenient for interrogation. And so Huss is in Tomato, and Gerald Draper is going to interrogate him. And I thought that you would be interested and that you could act as his interpreter. And I said, thank you very much. I am interested and I should be glad to act as his interpreter. Now, Gerald Draper, Major, Irish Guards, fully qualified as a barrister. And we set out. Now, Huss, current commandant of Auschwitz, was not of interest to us. Why? Because Auschwitz was not in the British zone, and all we really had to do was to try and trace the man who was known to be under assumed identity, somewhere south of Bremen, actually it was in the Flensburg area. And the people who traced him, members of war crimes, but in a separate section known as Haystack, because they were the people who were looking for the needle in the haystack. And they were asked to find X, Y, or Z who was particularly wanted, sometimes pulling them out of an internment camp, sometimes finding them elsewhere, but anyway, you know, out to get.
But Hirst was a name that was known to you, or he'd been on a wanted list that had...
Well, we had been told that he was living in the British zone and probably up there, and there it was. The mechanics of this, I don't know, but he had been traced and he had been arrested at 6 a.m. that morning, and that was the 11th of March, 1946. And on the way, Joe and I were discussing vaguely the lines of interrogation, and in particular, we tried to hit upon what was a reasonable number of people killed during the time of his tenancy as camp commandant. And we had, of course, information on the convoys, you know, that were there. We had a good deal of information on Auschwitz, certainly. And he said, oh, about 1.5 million. I said, like 1.5 million, you know? It's quite a lot, but, you know, today I still shudder when I think of these things and when I speak these numbers and when I imagine what 1 million people means. Right. So we get there and this little jail, the interrogation room, gave onto an inner courtyard. We settle, and Sergeant Blancs bring in the prisoner. In comes Mr. Hirst, looking very well, he's been on a farm. And he'd grown huge white moustaches and was pretty well disguised as a local yokel. And we started the interrogation by saying, so you are Blinkety Blanc, the assumed name. And he said, yes. And you've been on the farm, working on that farm, yes. And you had the impertinence, you had the lack of feeling, you had this greed to steal a bicycle from one of the workers, a foreigner at that. He said, oh, no, absolutely not. Well, that's what we accuse you of. He said, yes, but it's quite mistaken. I didn't do it. I have another bicycle. Absolutely wrong. Well, possibly. Possibly that's true. On the other hand, we do not think that you are XX, because we know that you are Rudolf Hirst, former camp commandant of Auschwitz. He swallows three times. Joe Baker pushes the button, the bell, and in comes our great sergeant. And take this gentleman outside and remove his moustaches. First is taken outside. He is led into the courtyard. And this is a scene that I shall never forget, because the sergeant takes her gently by the nose and moves one and the other moustache. Hirst is brought in clean shaven and looking more like his former self. And at that point, his knees were knocking. When you hear this, you'll beat me, but his knees were knocking. This man had absolutely collapsed on realizing that his game was up. And he started. And he no longer denied, yes, and from two giving the dates. Right. And we reckon that during the time that you were charged to come, the number of people killed, mostly by gassing, 1,500,000 people killed under your surveillance. And I said, oh no, oh no, absolutely no. So, well, gives your own figure. And this is something that one can't forget. Because this man upped the figure to over 2 million, something in the region of 2,300,000, whatever. Well, I mean, you are struck silent for a moment. And Gerald, being Irish, suddenly felt absolutely furious. And he shouted at him, why do you boast? Why do you boast? Why do you give that number? And he said, because when I took over it was this, and then it was that. And being German, and the fact that everyone on arrival in Auschwitz was branded like cattle with a number, he knew that that was the number, and that was right for him. Now, at that point, we said, right, are you prepared to make a statement to this effect? And he said, yes. And I wrote in German on all the bit of paper, I, Rudolf Hess, Sturmmanfer, whatever he was, camp on land in Auschwitz from 2. Well, the stake that he was having, something, 2 million, whatever the number was, killed. It was signed by him. And we left. It was the end of the interrogation. And that was the end of what I saw of us. Now, our business was to notify via Nuremberg the Russians, in whose zone Auschwitz was, that we had collected Hess and he was at the disposal of. Now, there was another interrogation at a later stage, I think it was the 16th of March, judging by some statement which appeared in the press. It was a statement taken by Gerald Draper with the assistance of another member of the war crimes legal team. And that was the end of Hearst for that is a fact. Now, the number given by the chief rabbi, Jacob Olbert, whom I happened to hear on the radio, was a million and a half in connection with this. I believe it is also in some newspaper article on Auschwitz. And I also remember that early 50s, I think, a friend, the war crimes friend, told me that Rudolf Hess's memoirs, his autobiography memoirs, were available in the German edition in the British Library. And he may finally lent me that book, which I glanced through in return. The story after Hess left us for Nuremberg, he was in Nuremberg for a while, as he himself describes, that was the happiest moment of his capture, because they were very well treated in Nuremberg, and he met similar people like Heindel and others who'd run camps. And he was then passed to the Russians, who had this extraordinary good idea of handing him over to the Poles. And the Poles said to him, "We will keep you here with ink, paper, and pen to write your memoirs," which he did. And to read the memoirs, which have now been translated, is not very enlightening, except as to the nature of a man, a very typical German split personality, you know, a devoted family man, loved his cats and dogs and his children. Naturally, he loves music. And naturally, everything that happened was unfortunate, and he could not help himself.
Do you know what the fate of the of his confession was? The one that that you took down, and he signed. What did was that document part of his file that went with him to the Russians?
No. I don't know at all. I mean, what happened to that bit of paper? That's somewhere in the records office, or what happened to the war crimes papers, I do not know. Mm. I really do not know. Because frankly, I didn't care. And none of us really care deeply about records and documents. You know, it's a strange thing that one did one's job, and that was that. And the idea of this being an historic occasion or anything else really did not register deeply at all.
So the interview was relatively short with him?
Very short. I suppose we were there for perhaps an hour in all, an hour and a quarter, roughly. That was what we wanted. We wanted to establish the identity of the man, and we wanted a statement from him. And the statement was roughly the number of people killed in Auschwitz.
And presumably from what you said, that people had deliberately kept from him their suspicions as to who he was prior to your confronting him.
He came in quite cock-a-hoop. Quite cock-a-hoop. He knew that he hadn't stolen a bicycle. And he had been arrested under his false identity. And as far as I can make out from his subsequent sudden collapse, when he was faced with the fact that we knew his identity, I think that did come to him as a very great shock. After all, he had lived there for over a year, and he felt securely established. So that is the bit about the interrogation at first, the first interrogation and establishment of this identity. Now there's another thing, which was that, again, with Gerard Raper, as it happens, I was out there to try and establish what had happened to various of our F-section agents whom we knew to have been captured, whom we knew to have been seen or believed to have been seen in various concentration camps. I had to assume they were killed, and I was trying to find out when and how and if. And for this, I had to travel very extensively to see the people I wished to interrogate, Germans who had been become guards or camp commandants or anyway, or even fellow prisoners. And for this particular thing, I wanted to see people who are being held in Nottingham. I have to look at the map, because they're coming this time. I'm not perfectly sure the town I'm looking for, but it's not a tip of my town. And I had two visits that I wished to make. And Gerald Draper had business at Nuremberg. He wished to I forget quite what it was in connection with which case. I don't remember, but anyway, he had business at Nuremberg. And in particular also to see a chap who was being held in the Landsberg prison near Munich, where Hitler wrote Mein Kampf. And that was a man whose name I have now forgotten, could be looked up, but I mean, I don't live with it. And he had been in charge of the gas chambers. He had been evacuated from Auschwitz to Mauthausen. Mauthausen was in Austria, on the borders of Austria, and it came under the American zone. The Americans had this particular guy who had already been tried, and he had the death sentence. He was awaiting execution in the Landsberg jail alongside a number of similars. And he had been convicted of the murder of one young inmate in Mauthausen. He got the death sentence at Mauthausen, but he had worked the most profitable years of his life, if one of the place was called, in the gas chambers in Auschwitz. Now at that time, Gerald Draper was collecting evidence for a case to be held in Hamburg, that was British zone, against a man called Tesch, T-E-S-C-H, who had, he was a well-known a respected family in Hamburg whose business had been the gassing, the clearing of ships,
fumigating
ships and warehouses in Hamburg. And he then had turned to producing the gas for the killing of humans. And he knew what he was doing, and he experimented, and he produced the gas granules, Cyclone B, and Cyclon B was used in all the gas chambers. If they're functioning at any point. And therefore, it was essential that one should have from the chap who had worked in the gas chambers confirmation of the fact that Cyclon B was used in Auschwitz, where more people were gassed than anywhere else. And this was another very dreadful experience. And of course, the Landsberg prison was a very forbidding place, and the death row was approached by various locked, mainly iron gates and so on. And the death row was lit by strip lighting, and the doors to the cells were like stable doors, and between every two cells was one GI with his white helmet, the snowdrops as we call them, and the tinting of doors. Every head popped out, and here was I, in a uniform woman, walking down, feeling more faint than I think I've ever done, to reach the door of this chap. And we entered, and I sat on this man's bed, in his bed, and he sat opposite to a draper, above a table in the dumpster. And this guy is Cyclone. Oh yes, I mean he is quietly placed. The wall is in yellow tin, and the weight and size and the mounts and all the technical detail and that. And then of course the disposal of the bodies. And this was something which I think is nowhere else recorded. And that is that one time they had this vast amount of human ashes which were filled in with not ditches, as we call them, dug. And they decided to experiment with these ashes to try and grow tobacco. By the use of these ashes. You see, these are things which no one can doubt that I heard. Of course, no one could imagine that I could imagine them. And yet I have not heard of this.
And this man was, he subsequently was executed by the Americans for this?
Yes, I mean, again, we had no interest. You see, one was far professional. One had a limited interest. The limited interest in this man was for Gerald Draper, the use of Cyclone B, in connection with the case forthcoming.